Welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm a resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School, and you are listening to KZSU, Stanford University. The topic today is a topic that actually is appropriate to the song that I've just played, which is the Kinks classic, A Dedicated Follower of Fashion, but a very serious and interesting topic that has gotten very little scholarly attention until recently. My guest today is Professor Chris Sprigman of the University of Virginia School of Law, and he, along with Cal Rustiala, who is a professor at UCLA, who is not on today, have authored a fascinating article dealing with an underexplored and really underanalyzed business from the perspective of copyright law. The topic of their article, which is forthcoming in Virginia Law Review, is called The Piracy Paradox, Innovation and Intellectual Property in Fashion Design. And the article's basic overarching thesis, which we'll be discussing in some detail today with Chris, is that the fashion industry is really operating in a sphere that doesn't include a use of copyright law. Copyright, which, you know, as I've discussed quite a bit on this show, and I've had many guests on to discuss it, is an area of law that increasingly intersects with technology. This is not a technology topic per se, but it's an illuminating area because what Chris's article, and I'll call it Chris's article, even though he has co-authors, but what Chris's article effectively points out is that there are businesses and there are spheres where the basic justifications for copyright law, that is, the need for innovation and the need to capture the value of one's work, may not be in play. And in fact, there may be instances where businesses and, in fact, industries can operate absent copyright protection quite effectively and successfully. So Chris's article, which it goes into enormous detail on this topic and really is, like I said, is a very, very illuminating analysis of an area of law that usually is perceived to be one where there's very little way to argue against the idea of innovation. And yet in this case, we don't have a need for something like that. So when I return from a short music break, I'm going to put Chris Sprigman on the air and allow him to do a little better job introducing himself and talk about the article, why he wrote it, and where we're going. If I've done my job properly, Chris Sprigman should be there. Chris, are you there?
I'm here.
Chris, thank you for being on today.
It's my pleasure.
And let's jump right in and kind of, first of all, I introduced you briefly, but maybe you could give a little more background for the listeners as to who you are, and then what the genesis and impetus was for this article.
Dave, so I'm an associate professor of law at the University of Virginia, and I work in the areas of intellectual property and antitrust, and what unites those two interests is really my overarching interest in competition and innovation. I'm interested in how legal rules affect those things, and this paper about the fashion industry is part of a broader interest in creative industries and how they innovate.
As I mentioned in my introduction, it appears, and you note this in your article, that fashion is an industry that has been almost not analyzed at all, or very, very little, in the intellectual property world. Why do you think that is?
Well, there isn't a lot of scholarship on the fashion industry from the perspective of intellectual property. There are some economists who write about the fashion industry from the perspective of industry performance. And there's some sociologists historically who've written about the fashion industry because they're interested in why, you know, people spend so much money on clothes. What's the social significance of the industry? But there isn't a lot of writing on the industry's funny innovation culture. And by funny, I mean typically when we think about IP, we think about the following public goods problem. Creative goods are often expensive to make, right? The first copy of a novel, the first copy of a piece of software, hundreds of hours, potentially thousands of hours involved in writing those things. So they're expensive to make, but once you make them, they're very, very cheap to copy. And so the orthodox thinking about this is, well, goods like that are expensive to invent but cheap to copy, we need some form of intellectual property protection, because if we don't, the copyist will, of course, have a tremendous advantage over the creator. The copyist doesn't have the thousands of hours of effort invested, so the copyist will just copy, outcompete the innovator, the creator, and this will disincentivize people to engage in creation. So that's the theory. Mm-hmm. And the theory makes a lot of sense. But there's a problem, and the problem is, you know, as a theory it may make sense, but when you look at the facts, sometimes quite large industries don't really line up with the theory very well. So the fashion industry, copyright doesn't apply. We can talk about why separately, but copyright doesn't apply. And we get lots of copying, right? We have lots of what other people might refer to as piracy, where designers appropriate others' creativity. We see lots of clothes that look the same, that respond to original and attractive designs, and yet we see tons of investment in innovation, production of new designs all the time, and the industry thrives. So that was the puzzle for me, is how does the industry thrive? And Cal and I started looking at that a couple of years ago.
So before we get into the crux of your article, I just kind of want to get a little background on the fashion industry as you understand it. So I, you know, if I'm going into your average middle level, as it were, store to buy just a basic piece of clothing. So I go into a Gap, and I buy a polo shirt. What, based upon your research, where does that design come from? Is there a basic world of designs that pretty much everyone uses and everyone just accepts as the way to design a polo shirt? You have a certain color and a certain cut to it, or is there something broader than that going on? In other words, how much am I buying when I buy my shirt?
Yeah, well, the fashion industry is segmented into different kinds of businesses, right? So at the top of the fashion industry is this business in couture, right? And that comes in both custom and also ready-to-wear. And these are clothes that cost a lot of money. The designs are changing all the time. And the famous fashion firms of the world, Prada or Chanel, they operate in this environment. Now, below that are a number of different things, right? So there are bridge lines where famous design houses, say like Dolce and Gabbana, they have a couture line. They also have a bridge line, which is a cheaper collection, typically inspired by their couture collection, but offered at a lower price, sometimes a lower level of workmanship, although sometimes not. And then below that, you have what's kind of loosely referred to as better clothing, which is, you know, still relatively expensive, good quality clothing. Designs also change seasonally. So think of your Banana Republic, right? Every season, the stock of that store changes. And there's some stuff in there that's quite, intensely, you know, infused with design content. And then there's some stuff in there like khakis or, long sleeve t-shirts that are really not. They're pretty standard items. And as you move further down the kind of fashion industry structure, you know, there's a store like the Gap where more of the clothing is kind of standard, durable in terms of its design appeal, khakis, jeans, t-shirts, you know, basic button shirts, etc. Mm-hmm. So depending on what kind of clothing you're buying, there's more or less design content. But it's worth noting that even at the lower end, the designs do change over time, sometimes subtly, but they change.
So I'm wearing a shirt right now, which I'm proud to say I bought at Target, because that's my style of clothing at the moment.
Well, Target's actually an innovator in this area. They are in fact marketing more and more clothing with quite a bit of design content.
Well, that's what I was actually going to go where I was going, which is exactly that point. I walked into Target to buy this shirt, and I find that there are designers like Mizrahi,
right,
who have been contracted with a store, which I'm assuming is the brand Target and the chain Target, to design particularized clothing for their chain. So I do want to dive into that wrinkle a little bit in terms of the structure of your paper, but again, for purposes of getting an idea of the industry, that seems like a relatively new phenomena and seems like something that would potentially impact the analysis that we're going to discuss in a moment.
Well, maybe. That is relatively new. And let's just try to be clear on what the legal regime is. So Isaac Mizrahi may design a collection for Target. The brands under which that collection is marketed are protected by trademark law, right? So another business can't come along and copy the Target marks, right? But another company can come along and they can copy the garment's design. They can't copy the marks, but they can copy the design. And that's that freedom to copy a piece of clothing's design has been longstanding, under U.S. law at least. And so what you see in the industry as a whole is a lot of design innovation and also a lot of copying.
And the industry itself, when we're talking about the genesis of the industry, I mean, how far back do you feel that there is something called a fashion industry in the United States?
Well, it depends on the scale that you want to talk about. So there's been a fashion industry for a long time at an elite level, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it's only maybe since the 1920s that mass fashion became an industry in the States and in Europe. Right, the spread of affluence. You began to get people think of clothes as a durable good, as a good they buy for its status conferring value, rather than a good they buy to wear until it wears out. Now, you know, personally, I know lots of people who still treat clothing as a durable good, but you know, more and more people over time have treated clothing as a positional good, a status conferring good, and that's of course the change in the way people think of clothing that makes a mass fashion industry like we have today possible. That turns out to be pretty key to why Cal and I think we have so far anyway a durable regime in the United States of freedom to appropriate designs.
Well, let's get right into that. So the title of your article is The Piracy Paradox, which I think by asking what that means ultimately gets to what is the core assertion of your paper. So why don't you first describe that for us?
Sure. So for at least the last 60 years or so, there has been freedom in this country to copy clothing designs. The reason for that is that the copyright law has a doctrine in it called the Useful Articles Doctrine. And what that means is things like clothing or furniture, for example, or utensils that have both an expressive function, a beauty, an aesthetic quality, and a useful function. So in the case of clothes, covering, you know, nakedness. Copyright law does not cover these things unless the expressive function is somehow separable. And of course the beauty of most clothing is kind of distilled into its design. There's no sense in which you can market the design separately from the article of clothing, typically. And so most clothing is held to be outside of copyright law's domain. Back in the 20s and 30s, there actually was a cartel in the United States of clothing designers that sought to prevent copying by members of the cartel, but that cartel was actually busted up by the U.S. government. And ever since then, the copyright law hasn't protected clothing designs, and the cartel hasn't been around to protect them either. Now, according to the orthodox account of why we have IP laws, what that should have resulted in is a whole bunch of piracy and ruination of the industry. You got a whole bunch of piracy, but the industry grew. Grew very robustly. And so the question that Cal and I were interested in is, how can that be? So we started to think about the fashion industry, and a couple of dynamics became clear to us over time. The first is, of course, that clothing is an industry where there's innovation on a seasonal basis, right? There's a pretty quick cycle of innovation. And so the clothing manufacturers face a couple of problems. One problem is they need to prepare folks to, you know, accept and be hungry for the next round of innovation, which is coming pretty quickly. So how do they do that? Well, they innovate, they create appealing designs, and then copying starts. And as these appealing designs are copied, they are spread more and more widely, right? They get spread quicker throughout the population than if they weren't copied at all, if they were just kept to the original creator. And the result of this is, you know, as these designs spread, they become less appealing to early adopters, right? And a sociologist named Georg Simmel noted this. He said, as fashion spreads, it goes to its doom, right? As something spreads past a certain point, it becomes less appealing to people who like to think of themselves on the cutting edge, and these people are ready quicker to chase the next new thing. Right, so this is a dynamic we call induced obsolescence. The fashion industry, because of the rapidity of its design cycle, they want to get designs out, and then they want to kill them, right? Mm-hmm. Slightly paradoxical. So if that's what they want to do, they've got another problem that they have to solve, and that is, well, how do they communicate to people that the mode, the fashion, has actually changed? And copying is important here, too, because what you see in the industry, season after season after season, is a number of design themes becoming very popular and being widely copied. And this gives coherence to the mode, right, to the new fashion, so that when you walk into Nordstrom or some shop, you don't see, a huge, bewildering variety of clothing all, responding to its own muse. What you see is a variety of clothing, but you see some trends, you see some coherence to a year's design output. And the message that the fashion industry is sending you is, here are the design themes that are going to be in fashion now, and here's what you have to buy to stay in fashion. Mm-hmm. And they offer you a variety of choices that might fit your body, might fit your wallet, within any particular set of design themes that are going to be widely copied and therefore widely worn this year. So this we call the anchoring process, and the idea here is, if you're constantly inducing people to chase the new thing, you've got to tell them what the new thing is. Mm-hmm. Copying helps that, too. So the overall upshot here is that copying is, in fact, part of how the industry innovates, right? Rather than being deaf to innovation in the fashion industry, copying actually might be a predicate to innovation in the fashion industry.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a thing that we think is kind of interesting in itself, but it then raises another question, which is, are there other industries that might have an innovation dynamic kind of like this?
Right. This is fertile ground for discussion, and alas, I'm sure that in an hour or even less that we have, we won't cover all of it. But let me take a few of these areas. First, getting back to the idea that piracy is ultimately helping the industry innovate, which you didn't say it outright, but I'll say, kind of turns the whole theory of copyright law on its head. And you point out in your article, looking at other industries like music and entertainment and what have you. But one thing that occurs to me as I was reading the article and I wanted to mention to you was, and get your reaction to, is that it kind of sounds a little bit like the long tail, the business idea that's been kicking around that I know you're familiar with, but for listeners who aren't, it's the basic idea in technology, which is that the internet and modern ways of marketing will allow for a product to have a much longer shelf life in the long term, that there'll be ways to market to the very specific buyer as opposed to a mass marketing model that has existed generally up to now. And there are critics of this theory. But what it sounds to me at some level that you're saying is that at the margins, the fashion industry can allow for people to continue to buy for a certain period of time, and then so long as they're still selling some kind of clothing, they operate and they can continue doing business. When we're talking about copyright here, I want to make sure I'm clear. We're talking about copyright protection in the design itself, and I do want to distinguish that for. And you mentioned it in the beginning, but I think it's important. You are not suggesting in your paper that trademark law is something that is treated any differently than any other industry.
Not at all.
Okay.
No, trademark of course is important in the fashion industry, and trademark violations are prosecuted,
mm-hmm.
Both privately by the industry and otherwise, in terms of anti-counterfeiting laws. So I'm at peace with trademark in the industry, and my point really, and my Cal's point and mine is a particular point, which is that This industry, this particular industry, innovates in a way that would lead one to question whether copyright has any place mm-hmm. in the regulation of design in the fashion industry. You know, I'm not saying, and Cal's not saying in this paper, that we should overturn copyright for the music industry or for the motion picture industry or for the publishing industry. What we're saying is something, I think, more modest but nonetheless quite important, which is, okay, fashion is probably around the world a $1 trillion industry. Mm-hmm. It's a big, big concern. It's bigger than the motion picture industry. It's bigger than the music industry. It's bigger than the publishing industry. And it runs by rules and innovates and thrives under rules that have little to do with copyright or really any other form of IP other than trademark. Trademark, of course, covers brands but not designs. So mm-hmm. the designs are free as air to common use. If you see something like that, it should lead you to think that our orthodox justification for IP, right, is a good theoretical justification, but whether it's going to actually work or not depends on what industry you're talking about. And so, you know, what we're saying, what Cal and I are saying is related to what others like Mark Lemley and Dan Burke have said about patent law, for example, that we should think more about the particular characteristics of innovation in particular industries. We shouldn't try a one-size-fits-all. We should think more about rules for particular industries, different horses for different courses. I think that's the ultimate upshot of this paper.
Is it the long tail?
Well, no, I think it's a different phenomenon because the long tail is something that arises in a world that we're living in now where, you know, so online downloading of music. iTunes can conceivably offer, you know, the entire catalog, right, and do it economically, whereas a brick-and-mortar store really couldn't. And the idea is that, you know, you might get a lot of consumption of stuff that would be uneconomic in a brick-and-mortar world but is perfectly economic in an online world. And this opens up some exciting possibilities for, you know, our culture really becoming more enduring. Mm-hmm. So this is somewhat different in the sense that, you know, fashion is really a study in ephemera. Most fashions live and die very quickly. There are relatively few designs that have any kind of persistence. So fashion is actually a really short tail mm-hmm. From season to season with the occasional outlier.
Mm-hmm. Is it something that is from your article, one could, you clearly, I think, paint a picture of an industry that, you know, is driven by whatever's happening at a given moment. But also the industry itself operates to set the trend.
Sure.
And I'm curious how that dynamic factors into their analysis or their lack of use, as it were, of copyright. I mean, you could say the same about music, that your traditional A&R music executive's goal was to identify the next big thing. But
right.
but in fashion, we're talking about something that's even more concrete, which is that the year's fashions, as it were, are coming out of a few cities in a few particular areas, and whether it's New York or Milan or London, you've got a very limited group of people that are saying, hey, this is what you should be wearing.
Sure.
How does that factor into your analysis?
Okay, well, you know, we're on the radio, so I can't show pictures, which
right.
is kind of too bad.
That's the toughest thing about this medium.
But, you know, the article, the Piracy Paradox article, is coming out in the Virginia Law Review in December, and mm-hmm. One of the things that you'll see in the article, if you read it, is a URL where you can go and you can look in color at pictures of things that we're talking about in the article. So your question is interesting. What is the correlation, if there is one, between kind of trends in fashion and trends in music, and does the role of kind of a system of free appropriation, a kind of copyright-free system in fashion, suggest that, you know, the same dynamic that leads to innovation in fashion might lead to innovation in music? And I mean, I think, you know, our paper isn't about this, but provisionally, I think my answer is no. These things are actually very different. Hmm. That the fashion industry is really all about trends, and the music industry is only mildly about trends. Right, so you can think back to trends in music. You can think of, you know, the 90s, and you think of grunge, for example. And yeah, there's a trend there in the sense that there are a bunch of bands that kind of sound alike. But that isn't really the whole story. Whereas in fashion, that's really the story, right? Every season, as you say, a designer is in a small number of cities, kind of set trends. But they don't do it themselves, right? It's a complex process. It's designers. It's the public that kind of pays attention to some designs and not others. It's the fashion press, right? It's a complex conversation between, you know, designers and audience. But somehow, out of this black box, every year we get recognizable trends. So a couple of years ago, you know, women in the spring started wearing these bohemian skirts, right? These skirts made of kind of tiers of cotton, typically cotton fabric. The tiers are kind of separated by little lace panels, typically a drawstring waist, right? You've seen these bohemian skirts. They were really hot a couple of years ago for a period of some months. You know, hundreds of firms copied and spun out variations on this basic design. This is reminiscent of something that came before, but it wasn't exactly like what came before. It was its own creature.
Mm-hmm.
And all these things appeared at once, and then we moved on. Now, how does that happen? Well, that's worthy of a paper in itself, right? The trend-making process is really interesting. But for our purposes, we note that happens, and that happens because people copy. And they don't just copy point for point. They don't make exact replicas, but what they do is they take some basic design ideas and they play with them. So the whole industry is devoted to that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Playing with other people's ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And this is how we set a trend. What induces squads of young women to go out and buy a bohemian skirt? Well, people who they think are fashion savvy are wearing them, right? And then it moves past a certain point where, you know, everyone on the block has one, and the positional quality, the status conferring quality of that thing is diminished, and we move on.
Hmm.
So one more story in this regard. So a couple of years ago, it was spring 2005, I think, I was in a Nordstrom, and there was a table in this Nordstrom. I was looking for some shoes, and there was a table where there were, a couple of dozen at least, maybe more, of very similar looking moccasins called driving shoes arrayed on this table. And the driving shoe is basically a moccasin with a kind of pebble-like rubber sole that runs up the back. And
mm-hmm.
there's pictures of this in our paper.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, why in spring of 2005 was pretty much every shoe manufacturer that I could think of turning out one of these things? The answer is nobody knows. Right? It wasn't like some guys sitting in a room smoking cigars and deciding that this was going to be the year of the driving shoe. There was a much more subtle process that led to the efflorescence of this particular design. But the fact is, you know, what was the message that the industry was sending me? The message was, okay, so we've moved on here. We've got a new mode. One of the designs for men in spring 2005 for shoes is the driving shoe.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone's going to make one. Pick one. Right? And by picking one, you will locate yourself in the current fashion. Whatever status conferring value this current design has, you're going to get. And enjoy it while it lasts.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Be ready to buy the next one
right.
when we announce it. So that's the basic creative dynamic, and it produces a lot of consumption.
It's we're going to take a short music break, but when I come back, I kind of want to turn to that and in the time we have left, kind of see where this piracy paradox leaves us in terms of how we view intellectual property law generally. And I know you've said you're not looking to apply this theory to other industries, but I'm curious to see where you think we're going there. And also on the legislative side, as I understand, there are efforts afoot to actually now impose a certain amount of copyright protection in the industry.
That's right.
We will continue talking with Chris Sprigman about his article, The Piracy Paradox, Innovation and Intellectual Property in Fashion Design. Before we return with Chris Sprigman, you are listening to Hearsay Culture on KZSU-FM Stanford. I want to ask you if you like what you're hearing. And if you do, but even if you don't and you like other things that you hear on the show, on the station, but hopefully you like this show. Help me make sure that KZSU can continue providing great programs without commercials. Donate to KZSU. For more information, you can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, that's underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. And please keep listening. So we're back here with Chris. And, Chris, let's jump right in the time we have left to taking a look at what this means for IP law generally. So
sure.
if you were to summarize how we should reconfigure our thinking, or what one area we should reconfigure or at least reconsider our thinking about, what would it be?
Okay, so the summary would be that we who are interested in IP typically are interested in places where IP is, and we haven't really been looking very hard at places where IP isn't. Now, there are lots of creative industries where IP isn't. And when you start looking around, you start noticing them. So food, right? Recipes. A few thousand years ago, in the Greek city-state of Sybaris, we have some evidence of the first IP system that we know about. And it turns out that it was an IP system dedicated to providing exclusive rights and recipes. You know, apparently the Sybarites were Sybaritic, and they wanted recipes, and they decided that they would give IP rights in them, right? So they made a bet on IP being a good way to incent the creation of recipes. We go the other way. We don't typically protect recipes very deeply. We give some kind of minimal copyright protection to parts of recipes that are kind of purely expressive rather than the process of just telling people how to make a souffle or something. You know, look around. We have bookstore shelves, you know, groaning under the weight of cookbooks. We don't have a problem with the production of new cookery. When you start looking around, you see lots of other things where creativity is, but IP isn't. I'm thinking, for example, of sports plays. Right? There have been some articles recently about some innovative football offenses. One at Texas Tech, the other at the University of West Virginia. These football offenses are designed by coaches who are themselves creators. These things, if they're useful and they're novel, could be the subject of patent rights, and they're typically not, right? Now, why is that? Maybe there's a dynamic there. If we looked more closely at competitive sports, we would see why IP typically hasn't intruded there.
Mm-hmm.
Furniture, you know, useful articles like utensils, all these things should be looked at one by one. And we should dope out, you know, perfume. There are lots of smells alike perfumes, right? And there isn't, at least in this country, copyright on scents.
Mm-hmm.
Why? There's no doctrinal barrier necessarily to copyright on scents. There's copyright on sounds. So why is the perfume industry doing what it's doing, performing as it's performing, where their basic selling point, their scent is not protected?
You know, it goes a little further afield than the topic of your article, but the first thing that comes to mind in answering that question really boils down to who's been able to, you know, using cliches, you know, invent the better wheel, invent the better process, invent the better system of doing things. The entertainment industry, the music industry in particular, has been the subject of much criticism for basically not taking advantage of new technologies as they develop. And rather than harnessing them and using them to their economic advantage, they've been accused of really trying to shut down that competition. And it seems like what you're describing in some of these other industries, perhaps, are industries where simply people are able to do what they need to do without having to use a hammer to get their competition out of the way.
Yeah, there's an argument that, you know, with the music industry, part of the problem with the music industry is that there's been so much fighting over IP rights that they've kind of lost focus on providing the product that people want in the form that people want it at a price that people are willing to pay.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, I think it's really complicated. I think that's, you know, that's one perspective. It's probably an oversimplification.
Right.
But, you know, one thing I think we all should be thinking about is under what circumstances and in what industries do the kind of heavy-duty industrial-strength IP rights that we typically have under U.S. law actually work?
Mm-hmm.
And where are they more of a distraction than a help?
Well, speaking of distractions and help, in the time that we have left, I think it would be interesting to delve into this a little bit. So, as I mentioned at the beginning of the show, and you can inform our listeners, we have a situation now where Congress is actually looking at imposing, I suppose that's the right word, imposing and intellectual property rights system on the fashion industry. What? Tell us a little bit about that. And first of all, does it have any connection with your article? I mean, if you'd like to take credit for it, by all means do.
No, it's nothing I feel like I could take credit for.
All right.
Even if I thought I had caused it, I wouldn't take credit. I would actually probably assume blame. So this is a bill that's been introduced in the House, and it's been introduced by a gentleman from Virginia, Representative Bob Goodlatte. This is called H.R. 5055, and it would essentially create, for the fashion industry, a copyright-like right, but of a much shorter duration than copyright's typical term, which is life plus 70 for individual creators or a very long period for corporate works. So this is a 3-year period.
Mm-hmm.
Nonetheless, I think it's a really bad idea. There's no suggestion that I've seen that this is in any way necessary, right? We typically impose IP rights because we worry about incentives to create. I think one thing that most people who spend any time looking at the fashion industry agree on is that it's intensely creative, right? I mean, think of the fashion industry versus, say, the music industry, where, mm-hmm. you know, the recorded music industry is dominated by 4 large firms. The fashion industry is got hundreds of firms, battling away. It's very competitive. There's new entry all the time. It's exactly what you'd want in a creative, competitive industry.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of change, lots of profits. You know, some people don't win, but some people do. This is the kind of thing that we should cherish. I don't see any reason why we should go messing with it. But aside from, you know, the question of do we need it, there's a danger that we actually might succeed if the Congress were to pass H.R. 5055 and impose a kind of copyright regime on fashion.
Mm-hmm.
We might actually succeed in hurting the industry for some of the reasons that I mentioned before. I mean, the industry innovates in part through the process of copying. It copies and spins out variations on, you know, a set of attractive designs every season. And this allows the industry to maintain its very quick cycle of innovation, you know, by getting people familiar with and then sick of new stuff in time for them to buy the next round of innovation, and also by signaling to people what the new fashion is by, you know, repeating it, copying it again and again.
Mm-hmm.
That dynamic seems a workable, viable dynamic, has been the dynamic for a while, and, you know, if you impose legal rules on it that make that dynamic basically actionable as copyright infringement, chances are that you might, you know, kind of drop a bomb into the creative ecosystem that you've built up over years.
It's interesting, because Representative Goodlatte is also someone that for a long time has been behind the efforts to make online gaming illegal. And in fact, that's something which to a lot of people's surprise is something which actually has made it through Congress, where there's now, and now if the president signs it, and the expectation is that he will, it will be illegal for banks to process any transactions involving gaming. Goodlatte, I don't want to focus on him specifically, but the broader issue is Goodlatte has said that he views gaming as a social vice and what have you, and then doesn't want children involved in it, and now he's looking to oppose this rights system. I'm curious, not speaking specifically to Goodlatte, but looking at some of the impetus behind this, what if it wasn't the brilliance of your article, and I can say this stuff as a host, I'll throw in some accolades, but I really do think it's a great article. If it wasn't your article, why is this suddenly coming up?
Well, so I think obviously over the last, you know, quarter century or so, the story, at least for copyright, has been this, you know, ever-expanding set of rights. And we're living in an age where, you know, from the perspective of people who believe in the IP system, every problem with innovation seems to call for an IP solution. Now, I don't think the fashion industry has a problem with innovation. I think the fashion industry is kind of a model, you know, kind of a poster child for innovation. You know, you may or may not value the kind of innovation that they do, right? So there's some people who've reacted to our paper by saying, oh, you know, this is all silly. Why should we care about the innovative dynamic in this industry? And I guess, you know, I care because people spend enormous amounts of time and money on this industry. They obviously perceive some value in it, right? And I don't, I'm typically not in the business of kind of second guessing where people choose to spend their efforts and money. So if you take, you know, people voting with their money as a sign that this industry is important to them, you know, we should think about it. And I frankly just don't think that the people involved in trying to pass this bill have fought very hard about how the industry actually works.
Mm-hmm.
Now that's maybe not surprising because, you know, when you think about individual designers, for example, who design something that they, you know, think is very attractive and that they love, that they feel responsible for, someone goes and copies it, you know, that's annoying.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand that they feel hurt and, you know, my sympathies are with them. The only thing I would ask them to do is, you know, I would ask them to look in the mirror and ask themselves honestly if they've ever taken inspiration from someone else.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, lots of designers will tell you when you ask them that question, they say, "Yeah, you know, I have," because that's the way the industry works, right? We look at each other's work all the time and we reference it, right? We pay homage, and this is the way the industry innovates. That's the point of our paper.
Mm-hmm.
This is the paradox, right? That piracy actually can cause harm to individuals, but it causes great benefits in the aggregate. And that's the, you know, that's the thing that I think is worth preserving.
The article is The Piracy Paradox, Innovation in Intellectual Property and Fashion Design, coming out at the end of the year in the Virginia Law Review. It's somewhat unusual to be recommending that people go to law reviews who aren't, in fact, in the legal field or scholars and law professors. But this is one of what I hope will be more and more examples of law review articles that are really and should be read and can be read by people who are not attorneys and who are interested in how businesses innovate. The article is a draft that I have, which is the August draft. Is very, a very interesting read, and I want to, Chris, in closing, kind of read you one quote back to you.
Yeah.
From your article, but you say on page 44 of your draft, while some runway fashion can indeed induce nausea, we think it is the positional nature of fashion as a status-conferring good rather than any abstract aesthetic principle that drives the fashion cycle, leading status seekers regularly to acquire new clothing even when the old remains fully serviceable. And it seems like that analysis is so prescient to in fact, I think more industries than maybe even you're giving yourself credit for. And I think to me that at the end of the day, the article can really serve as a very valuable way to undergird the point that you made earlier, which Mark Lemley and others have made, which is that having a cookie-cutter approach to property generally, now we're going beyond intellectual property, is problematic as we have more and more industries operating. In the last remaining minute, any reaction to that?
Yeah, so one thing, I mean, that quote that you read was responding to something that the famous writer Thorstein Veblen said about fashion. He had a theory for why fashion changes all the time, and it was because basically fashion was kind of nausea-inducing, and so people would consume, they would get sick of it, and then flee. We don't think that. We think actually the industry is much more active in spreading designs quickly through copying and getting people to start of latch on to the next thing because they want the status that the next thing is going to bring them. The status is diffused from the thing that they own.
That positional nature that you referred
to. Yeah, and you know, does this apply, for example, to music? Well, you know, the consumption of music is changing in the sense that people now consume music in a much more public way. For example, they give each other their iPod playlists. When they do that, their consumption of music takes on some of this positional characteristic that their consumption of fashion takes on. I don't know if music is ever going to get where fashion is, where it's really a positional, it's a status-conferring good. I don't know what the future is going to bring, but I think it's worth thinking about all of these systems on the individual industry level, which requires less abstract thinking and more kind of concrete observation of the way industries actually run.
Chris Sprigman, thank you for being today on the show and having a fascinating discussion occurring by telephone with you sitting in your office at the University of Virginia, where I think the weather, by the way, might be somewhat similar because we've had some overcast weather here in the Bay Area, which kind of reminded me of my time on the East Coast.
Yeah, it's been a little nasty here, too. Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much, Chris. I want to thank Chris Brigman again for being on today and discussing his article, which I commend to everyone listening. And it causes me to rethink where we are, and I think Chris's article kind of sets us in further in the direction of eliminating or at least reconsidering the, as I was mentioning, the cookie-cutter approach to property generally that I think is increasingly problematic. I didn't get a chance to discuss it with Chris, but some of what he's saying reminds me of the commons theory that Professor Lessig and Yochai Benkler and Jamie Boyle and others have written about extensively, the idea that there are other ways for industries to operate short of propertizing everything that they do. I'm very excited to point out that I will be having a number of guests coming out in the coming weeks and months that are authors. Starting off, several authors that I'm going to have on, I'm pleased to mention that I'll be having Professor Alistair Roberts from Syracuse on discussing his work called Blacked Out, about government secrecy, as well as Eric Davis, the author of Tegnosis, and Eric von Hippel, the author of Democratizing Innovation. Those are some of the authors that I'm going to be having on in the coming months. Also, Henry Chesbro, who's written a great book called Open Innovation, along the lines of what I've just mentioned about different industries actually spurning secrecy in favor of more transparency in an effort to build their businesses. Next week, I'm going to have on Elizabeth Townsend-Gard, who is a visiting professor at Seattle University, and the co-author of the podcasting guide that I had discussed with Colette Vogel several months ago. I'm going to have Elizabeth on to discuss her work and some of the other areas that she's exploring. And also, probably most unusually for this show, is I am pleased to mention that I will have on Alyssa Hecker, who is an attorney in New York, and whose background is comes from the music industry and the Harry Fox Agency. And we're going to have a bit of a debate about copyright law in that industry, and I'm looking forward to having that discussion. Alyssa's perspective on this is different than mine, and I think it should be a lively discussion of copyright law and some of the issues that have been kicking around. So you've been listening to Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. Again, I'm a resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. Hearsay Culture can be heard on KZSU Wednesdays from 5 to 6 p.m. That's Pacific Standard Time for those of you listening on the Internet. It is also a podcast, and you can find it by going to the iTunes podcast page and typing in Center for Internet and Society, where you'll not only find all the shows that I've done, but also events that have occurred at the Center for Internet and Society. And finally, my webpage is that much closer. I'm actually uploading content this week, and hope to be able to have the page live next week. And that will fulfill the promise that I've made for the last few months to try to get a web page that allows you to listen in to the show and at the same time find links connected to the topics that I've discussed with a particular guest. So hopefully that will be online quite soon. Thank you for listening. Please stay tuned for more innovative and exciting programming on KZSU, and have a great day.